Hi, this is Marlene with Miami Ghost Chronicles, and I want to welcome you to another episode of Stories of the Supernatural. Wherever you find us, whether it's a video or podcast on your favorite platform, please like and subscribe to us so that you can get notification of when a new show is released. You can also find us on major social media platforms. If you go to MiamiGhostChronicles.com, you can find links to the videos or MP3 files, which you can download and enjoy without commercial interruptions. If you're into classic horror, ghost, and adventure stories, I narrate Nightshade Diary, and you can find links at nightshadediary.com. If scary stories are your bag, and listening to encounters with cryptids, ghosts, dogmen, and other weird creatures sends a shiver up your spine, then go to supernaturalstorytime.com for links to our weekly podcasts. Noteworthy news about the paranormal world, true crime, conspiracy stories, and anything that is just plain weird can be found at eerie.news or visit the Stranger Than Fiction Stories tab at MiamiGhostChronicles.com. Please subscribe to my newsletter on Substack. Just go to mppelliser.com for a link. I want to thank you for being part of my audience, and I think you are all wonderful.
Hi, everybody. How's everybody doing? Good, I hope. As you know, even though the show was staggered a couple of days ago, I did the live stream for Mardi Gras. So for those of you, I already got some people that, you know, weren't able to see the live stream, but they already saw it's been uploaded as far as being a regular video and also a podcast version. And I've had good feedback from a lot of you guys that weren't able to come in for the live stream. And as far as that, you know, here we are again going into, you know, to springtime, because this is partly, even though Mardi Gras, the origins, of course, where it's a Catholic holiday pre-Easter, Lent, and everything. All of this, of course, leads into the preparation for spring, et cetera, all that neat stuff. And a lot of interesting things happening. Things are good here. Kind of crazy, but at the same time, good and interesting. And again, I want to remind you, don't forget to sign up for my Substack newsletter. All right. Go to mppelliser.com and you're going to find a link there, miamighostchronicles.com. And I send something out like maybe every 3 or 4 days. Again, it's articles, recordings, podcast versions of some of the shows, and then some older videos, which are still really good, by the way, not because of anything, but, you know, I look at them before I set them up and it's like, is this still like, is there anything there? Is it worth seeing again? And yeah, you know, and believe it or not, the other day was, I can't believe some of them that date back to 2017, 2018. I had some guests when I looked at them that have passed away, believe it or not, in the intervening years. So anyway, but let's get on to the good part. And the good part is who I have as a guest today. This is the first time she's been here on Stories of the Supernatural. Her name is Rose Thornton, I'm sorry. Now, for 20 years, she's enjoyed a national reputation as an expert on old houses. She's the author of 9 books, and she's been featured on everything from PBS's History Detectives to BBC Radio. In 2016, her husband committed suicide, and 2 years later, Rose was diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. After a routine medical procedure, Rose bled to death. In heaven, she was told that if she agreed to return to Earth, she'd be restored to wholeness. Subsequently, medical tests affirmed that not only had the disease disappeared, but she was also healed of the crippling grief. Help me welcome her. How are you doing today, Rose?
Hi, thank you for that intro and the welcome. I appreciate it.
No, on the contrary, it's my pleasure. Okay, obviously, it seems like, and I asked you before we started recording, it seemed like this event, what happened with your husband and then your health crisis, it seemed like, was this like it sounds like almost like a big detour that occurred in your life, or was other things happening before that, before those events?
To say it was a big detour is kind of an understatement.
Okay.
I thought I had been a fan of all the self-improvement gurus, and I had mission statements and goals written out, and I had a very orderly plan for my life, where I would be in 30 days and 1 year and 2 years, right, and 5 years and all of that. And I wrote it out updated it every 30 days because I'm that thorough. And I had expected that my husband would probably live another 20 years. Mm-hmm. We had a good life. You know, in fact, I was the one. I'm the sensitive soul, the writer type, way right. too I ruminate over everything. Often when I would be sad, he would tell me, we have a good life. We have a lot of reasons to be happy. Okay. And I love that. I love that he did that. But anyway, he came home one day in April 2016, put a gun in his mouth and ended his life. And as a sensitive soul, to say it was devastating does not begin to describe what that did to me. To say it eviscerated me.
Yes.
And he was a successful professional, and I was a writer, and we had lots of nice friends, lots of fancy friends, and after this, they kind of scattered like rats deserting a sinking ship. And, you know, that happens. It's very common with trauma because people don't know what to do with you. They really don't know what to do with you.
Right.
So I lost my mind. I had a psychotic break. I lost my ability to function. And I ended up ultimately spending a couple nights in my car because I couldn't get comfortable anywhere. I didn't know where to go or what to do. And a very dear friend, her name was Tracy. She found out that I was getting awfully comfortable in that car. And she said, you're coming home with me tonight. I said, no, I'm not. I have nightmares. I scream at night. I can't sleep. I pace the house. Because I couldn't, I only stayed at my home for until the funeral was over. And then I left it. I mean, you know.
Sure.
How do you go back to that house? And she said, we'll just take this one day at a time. Well, I ended up living there for 4 months. And she was wonderful. And she would, she had known me as the successful author and all that stuff. And here I turned into this mess, this sorry, sorry mess. Mm-hmm. And after 4 months, I moved. And I moved in with another friend who took care of me for about a year and a half. And then I was able to live on my own, which just about the time I was able to live on my own. By the way, I was still dealing with crippling grief and incessant, dogmatic, horrific suicidal ideation. And every time I get this desire to end my own life, I would say, just wait 24 more hours, see how it looks tomorrow. And I was hanging on by my fingertips.
Was this, did you have these suicidal before, or was this, everything was after your husband's death?
After. All of this happened after.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, we did have a good life. We lived in a beautiful house in a beautiful place. We didn't have any financial worries. Mm-hmm. We had a little dog. I had a nice car. He had a nice truck. I mean, it was really a good life. Yeah, I kind of patted myself on the back and thought, well, shoot, this is the life I've been talking about in all those mission statements all these years. I finally got there. And to have it all taken away by his action was unbelievably bad. So, and you know, it was just an aside. One of the things that really I find very disturbing, we talk a lot about suicide prevention. That's kind of a buzzword now. And it makes me very angry, frankly, because if we want to talk about how to prevent suicide, when somebody loses a spouse or a child, I'm not talking about your father's, uncle's, brother's, cousin's barber, but when somebody loses a spouse or a child to suicide, the odds that they will take their own life go up 12 to 48 times, not percent, times. And so if we want to focus our efforts on saving people from suicide, look at the people who lost somebody very, very, very close to them to a suicide. Let's pay attention to them. In fact, what happens in society is people run away. Trauma scares people. Trauma terrifies people. Sure. They think, oh my gosh, I know her. She was my friend. I've read her books. If that happened to her, it can happen to me. So they flee. So, you know, if we're going to really have a serious conversation ever in this country about suicide prevention, we got to look at the people who do it, which are those who've lost somebody dear to them to suicide. I'm in a social media group called Sisterhood of Suicide Survivors, and it's 1,200 women just like me who've lost a spouse, lost a husband to suicide. And, you know, in that group of, I think it's about 1,200 people in that group, we've already lost 3 women to suicide.
Oh, boy.
That just can't take it. Yeah. So it's a real hot button for, and yeah, I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but
on the contrary, because it's like you said, you had this life and it sounds like you know, you had your plans and everything was manifested, all these goals, like you said that you had, and, you know, I was around in the '80s, you know, when the goal thing was going on, you know, like write down your goals. And it sounds like, for lack of a better word, like you had this perfect life. And then it's not that it upended. It was the reason got it upended. How's that?
It was a mess.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, the suicide prevention is just kind of chatter we tell ourselves until we get serious and we start looking at people like me, like the other women in that group, like somebody who's lost a spouse to suicide. So that was something I struggled with mightily, because when the smartest person you know, when the person you love the most, when they do this, it fries your brain. In fact, about 2 or 3 days or 4 days, I don't know. It took a week to have the funeral after my husband's suicide because they had to do an autopsy. And by the way, that's another thing. I've met widows from time to time who say, "Oh, honey, I know what you're going through. My husband died from a heart attack or a disease or whatever." And I try to be polite. I try. But the fact is, there's no comparison. When a woman... and I do a lot of podcasts, my book's done well, and I get a lot of emails. Well, the stories I hear are worse than my own, but one of the common themes, something I talk about, is when a woman's husband kills himself, especially at home, the wife becomes the lead suspect in a homicide investigation. And we get questioned, and I've gotten so many emails from women who say, yeah, not only did I get questioned, I got hauled down to the police station. One woman told me she got put in jail while the cops try to figure out. Well,
I've heard of that. Where
it's outrageous.
They're kind of victimized, fresh on dealing with the
re-victimized.
Death.
Yeah, I mean, you find out your husband killed himself, and you're like, I mean, it's yeah. So anyway, that's a real hot button for me too. In you know, just you're talking about the 80s. I mean, even in the 70s and I think into the 80s, when a woman was a victim of sexual assault, she got the, well, why were you on the street at 1 a.m? What were you doing in that part of town? What were you wearing? Right. Were you being provocative? Did you bring this on yourself?
Exactly.
We finally got away from that. Yeah. We now provide advocacy people for somebody who's been a victim of sexual assault. And we need to do that for suicide victims. We need to do that for, you know, we need an advocate to sit down at the police station or even when the cops question you. And the question they answered me, the question they asked me was, what was the nature of your last argument with him? And I said, what? And there was an argument. And by the way, that's very, 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 very common. I wish somebody had told me that. These people who end their own lives will often start an argument with the person they love the most. Because one, it helps them detach a little bit.
Right.
And two, it helps them feel less guilty. And three, if it's a revenge suicide, which approximately 10% of suicides are, they're like, I'll show you. You try to live your life after this happens.
It's exactly. It's almost like the person that has the last word in a way.
So we really need to comfort women and men and anybody who's been through the suicide of a loved one, a close loved one. So, yeah, I was jacked up. I was a sensitive soul anyway. I mean, way, way too sensitive. So then I, you know, a little bit after I'm living on my own in a nice little house, I had several unpleasant symptoms for several months. And, you know, it's funny. I had three prayers I prayed every night. One was, God, heal me or let me go. I can't take the pain anymore. Two, when I go, spare me the life of you. Because I had recurrent nightmares that I found man puts a Glock in his mouth, it's not pretty, you know?
Right.
I had recurrent nightmares about trying to get to him before he pulled the trigger, finding him right after, on and on, you get the point. My third prayer, I didn't want to see that again in a life review. I didn't want to see what happened to me. And then the third prayer was I had severe decision fatigue. I couldn't handle any more decisions. So I pray those three prayers every night. So then I have all these weird symptoms. I go to a doctor, go to another doctor, and they say, well, not only do you have cancer, cervical cancer, but it's advanced to a stage where your flesh is distorted. So there were tests, and it was affirmed, and it had already spread, and it was stage 2. And so they did a surgical biopsy to determine, you know, exactly what's going on and what needs to happen next. And after that surgical biopsy, I woke up and I told the RN, this was in a hospital, I told the RN, I'm bleeding profusely. She said, oh, once you get home and lie down, you'll be just fine. And she was wrong.
That's incredible.
Yes, I've since learned that gynecological bleeding is considered a life-threatening emergency for a good reason.
Yes,
so two more times, three times in total, I told her that this was severe. And I was 59. You know, I've been around a while. I've been wearing this particular jersey for a while. I know how things are supposed to work, you know? So anyway, I got sent home. At home, I realized it was getting worse. And I was actually standing in my shower because, you know, when you're bleeding to death, number one concern is making sure you keep the house clean. You don't want to stain the carpet. So I went and I stood in the car in the shower, my nice walk-in shower, because I was bleeding an awful lot. It was kind of amazing to me how much blood the human body can lose. And you're still like, I don't feel so good. This isn't working out for me.
Yeah.
And I was in that shower, I had the thought, you know, one of the prayers I prayed was 1 Corinthians 10:13, which says, God will show you a way out. And I thought, oh my gosh, maybe this is God's mercy. I didn't do this to myself. In fact, I sought medical care and now I'm bleeding to death. And if I sat down in the shower, nobody can say one word that I didn't do everything I could do. I even had a witness when I asked that nurse 3 times.
You know, so you were thinking, wrong. I'm off the hook.
I really was. So I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking, you know what? This is God's mercy. I'm out of here. And then I thought, once I sit down though, it's not, that'll be it. I knew it wouldn't be gone. And I thought about all the people who'd done so much to try to save me, you know, Tracy and my friends and on. I thought, oh man, I guess I better go to the hospital. So I stepped out of the shower, told my friends who were in the living room. I said, look, I need an ambulance. I'm bleeding out. So as one was summoned, I was taken to a little ER and it was not connected to a hospital. It was a standalone ER, which, by the way, I was back in town recently and I saw that ER and they've now built a hospital around it.
Well, so it apparently was like, an urgent care type of thing.
Yes, but it was an emergency room. It was a bona fide trauma, some level emergency room. So I'm taken by ambulance there. They put me on put me in a little cubicle. They take my blood pressure. They put a pulse ox on my finger and at this point, I'm like, you know what, let's get this show on the road. And there was an RN attending me at my left side while the doctor examined me. And I remember, this is pretty interesting. Hope I don't gross out your listeners.
No, but
doctor, a young doctor, she said, I can't see anything. There's so much blood everywhere. And I was like,
what do you think?
Probably not a good sign.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was holding this RN to my left. Lovely woman, very maternal. I mean, she really exuded mother love. She really exuded calm. And I grabbed her hand and I said, promise me you're not going to let me die. And she said, oh, honey, we have many solutions for this. You're not going to die. And I was like, I believe her. Oops. Okay. So then after the exam, they gave me a shot of Dilaudid, which is a morphine derivative, strong stuff. And then they left the room and left me alone with my friend who was sitting on a chair beside me. And I passed out pretty soon after that, Dilaudid. And what's really fascinating to me, it's great to have a witness to your life and also to your death, is he said, I'm unconscious on this gurney. And he said, at one point, I looked over the blood pressure machine and it said 32 over 25, which is pretty much gone.
Yeah.
And
that's like,
yeah.
Let me ask you, Kara, didn't when your blood pressure drop out, didn't like alarms or something go off, you know, that machinery, like somebody come running with a cart or anything like that?
Well, I think I'm not sure the success or the unfolding of events on this thing, but what happened next was my friend stood up and he leaned over me and he looked at me and he said, are you okay? Or no, actually, I think what happened next, he said, my eyes popped open. Have you ever heard of terminal lucidity?
No, but that means that. So, because I was going to ask you, it wasn't that you fell asleep or because of the medication, you went unconscious?
I think it was probably a combination of a lot of things.
Okay, okay.
That Dilaudid is very powerful.
Yeah,
I mean, morphine's, and also the funny thing about this is now I'm no doctor and I know pretty much nothing about medical stuff, but if you're down that low on blood, you know, if you're running a few pints low, and they put some Dilaudid into the IV, it hits your heart and your heart's like, what?
But yeah, this is what I'm curious. It's like, what were they thinking? What were they going to try to figure out? Like what?
Oh, it was not blood. A good move. Yeah, let's put some fluid in.
I'm not a doctor morphine. Either as far as, but you usually when somebody's losing blood from wherever, it's like, hey, we got to like stop the bleeding, put more blood in and
So what happened next? He said terminal lucidity often happens in people at the end of their life. And it's like they get a burst of energy. It's like Alzheimer's patients who have been silent for years will say, you know, I'm going to heaven, or somebody who's been blind can see. I mean, there's remarkable things. It's like the body summons the last bit of energy to do something that seems humanly impossible. So anyway, my eyes popped open when it hit 32 over 25. And my friend said, I tried to sit up on the gurney. And he said, you put your hands up like this. You couldn't sit up, okay. Put your hands up. And he said, you wiggled your fingers almost like you were waiting for somebody to pick you up, almost as a child would do for a parent. Okay. And he said, and then you said something. And that's when he stood up and he looked at me and he said, Rose, what do you need? And he said, and then I flopped back on the gurney. And then my blood pressure went to error, which meant it was lower than 32 over 25. That's when the alarm went off. And the attendant or the nurse came in, and this cracks me up. But he said she went over to the plug because she figured the plug had come out of the electrical outlet. So she's like, oh, the machine's not working. And then he said she fiddled with the cuff. And then he said she looked at me and she was like, uh-oh. And she did. Have you ever heard of the sternal rub? They do this thing where they take their knuckles and they rub it against your sternum. The idea is it elicits a pain response. So if you have any consciousness, you'll twitch or something. Well, Milton said there was no response whatsoever. So she got her little mic. You know, they had a mic on the scrubs and she said, I need the doctor in here now. And then they shooed him out. And that's when he said the crash cart came, you know, wheeling around the corner.
I'm flabbergasted. I'm waiting. At what point did they start deciding that they've got an emergency? Like time is of the essence kind of deal. Like what were they planning to? Maybe it's when you watch too much TV, and you think
So well, this was before COVID. Yeah, this was before COVID. So. There wasn't anybody in this little ER. I was the only show in town, but they should have paid a lot better attention to the events that were unfolding. They made an awful lot of mistakes actually. And then, he said that, she summoned the nurse on her scrubs and that's what she said was, this nurse summoned the doctor. She said, I need the doctor in here. And somebody said, well, she'll be there in a minute. She said, no, I need her right now. So I think they determined that it was an emergency at that point. Okay. And he went out in the hallway to wait. I mean, they put him out of the room. And then meanwhile, I was having a great time. I mean, I was having a great time. And all I remember was waking up out of what seemed like a deep, dreamless sleep and being catapulted out of my body. And I mean catapulted. And the imagery that I felt was that I had a sinewy, silvery, shimmery cord from the crown of my head to the back of my heels, the back of my feet. And it was somebody had pulled back on it like an archer's bow and let go. And it snapped. And that's when I went just flying. I mean, it all happened like that. It all happened concurrently. And I was floating away from my body. And I was like, whoa. And I thought, my heart has stopped. My very first words out of my new mouth or whatever was, my heart has stopped. And then I thought, how do I know that? I thought, I don't know how I know that, but I know that's right. And I'm floating further and further away from my body. My next thought being the writer. I've been a writer for 35 years. By the way, it's 10 books, not 9, but that's okay. my 10th book was about this experience. I thought, you're dying. And then I thought, no, actually, you're not dying. You're dead. Because, you know, when you're going on to your reward, the most important thing is correcting your tense. You don't want to get your tense wrong. Uh-huh. So that cracked me up. And that was actually a lovely moment because, one, I spoke out loud. My voice was as obvious as a parent as it is right now. I was talking to myself. I've lived alone a while. I have a dog. I talk to the dog like my alter ego, you know, like we all do. I thought it was remarkable that I sound just like I sound now. And I thought it was remarkable that I did not have breath sounds. I was pretty sure I didn't have lungs. I knew I didn't have vocal cords. And I didn't even have ears. I didn't think. And yet I'm producing and hearing sound. The other thing that was of inestimable comfort was that my goofball, macabre sense of humor had gone with me. And I thought about this. Even within the experience, I thought so much about the fact that every single thing I am had gone with me. And I thought, what did I leave behind on that gurney? And I thought, regret, guilt, despair, despondency, sadness, every negative emotion, anxiety, all of that. That's what I'd left behind. And I remember thinking, I've spent my whole life wondering what I would look like without any of those sad, negative facets. And I thought, this is pretty great. I like this person. So this, I mean, if you told me this thing went on for hours, I would have believed it. So much happened. I had spent my whole life reading NDE accounts. I found them fascinating for a lot of reasons. And I thought, this is it. And I also remember thinking, I always, you know, being a writer who overthinks every single thing, I remember thinking my whole life, I wondered how, you know, what's going to take you out? What's going to be the thing that finishes you off? And I thought it was a medical mistake. And I was I was born and raised as a Christian Scientist. And this was my first interface with the medical world. And I thought that was really ridiculously amusing. That the first engage with the medical world.
And let me ask you something. Did you have, since you were mentioning that thing about the NDE, did you have that classic tunnel thing or was it different?
I did not. In fact, after I was revived, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but I was taken by ambulance to one of the hospital. One of my first thoughts was, all my life I've been reading about NDEs and I just had one. Right. And here I am back. And I thought, it was nothing like what I've been reading about my whole life. And, you know, one of the top questions I get, one of the number one questions I get is, are you making this up? It's so funny. I get asked that a lot, which I think is a stitch. And I'm like, I'm a writer. I've read probably 50 books on NDEs. If I was going to make up a story, I'd have the chimes and I'd have the tunnel and I'd have my loved ones.
I've got a repertoire I could pull from.
That's right. I would not go off the rail with this story. So what I was going to say, I used to give this talk a lot in front of, or a few times in front of live audiences, you know, again, before COVID. But when I tell that story about being given to lauded when I'm bleeding out, it's funny. I can see the medical personnel in the crowd because they go,
You already know who they are, right?
That's right. Or when I say I got sent home, even though I was having a severe gynecological bleed, they go, oh, man. Because you don't do that. I've learned, because I interviewed several medical personnel for my book, and I've since learned that gynecological bleeding is considered a life-threatening emergency as severe.
You even have a lot of women, you know, in childbirth, they would die because of hemorrhaging sometimes. I mean, this was,
and you know, an interesting fact, I don't know the numbers anymore. And what I read was probably 20 years ago, back in the day, proportionately more women died from heart attacks than men. And the reason was when they went to the ER, they were told it's just anxiety. You need to calm down. You need to learn how to relax a little bit. And then they get sent home and their heart stops. So that's a problem.
They didn't see the symptoms. Which, by the way, I hear sometimes that the symptoms for women for like heart attacks is different. It's not like the typical, you know, what everybody thinks of as heart attack symptomology.
I've read that men's pain, well, who cares about that? Women's pain can radiate up into the jaw and it can radiate into the back. So it's not the classic left arm numb chest pain, but it can radiate up into their face. Anyway, so so I'm having the time of my life floating away from my body, and I was in perfect blackness. And I heard somebody else describe it as velvety blackness. This blackness was pitch black. And I even remember thinking, especially since my husband's suicide and the nightmares, I was terrified of the dark. And I would sleep with a light on, you know, just a light enough so I could find my way to the bathroom. But I thought, I'm terrified of the dark, but this is wonderful. It was blackness that was actively comforting me. And, you know, people talk a lot about the love, and I felt love, but I felt peace, the peace. I was like dipped into a vat of peace. And I even thought about, I'm pretty sure it's Corinthians. Paul talks about the peace that passeth all understanding. And I thought, this is that peace. And I was also comforted to realize all the Bible verses I had spent my life reading and memorizing, I still had them. And I had memories of, I even thought about my husband's suicide. And I thought, it's all over. It's, you know, I'm over all that. And I remember thinking that I was supposed to start chemo and radiation. I was going to have once a day radiation, 5 days a week, and then once a week chemo. And I thought, that's ceased to be a problem, hasn't it? Because and the intensity of all the memories of my time on Earth, and yet dying was so much like waking up from a detailed dream, an intense dream. And it was like all those worries and woes and fears and, oh no, what are they going to do? And what did this person do? And all this stuff. It was like, didn't matter. It was like,
it's almost because you hear about some NDEs where the person, the first thing they feel is that release from physical pain. But when I'm listening to you, it was that release from all this mental and emotional pain that you were undergoing. It was
even
like
spiritual pain.
Yeah, spiritual, everything. In other words, the physical was the least of it. It was.
There wasn't really much physical pain. Bleeding out is actually a pretty good way to go. You just go, I'm really sleepy. You know, and then they give you Dilaudid and then you're going on to your reward. But one of the things that happened very early on was I felt this massive spiritual being join me. And she was to my left, much taller than me, and slightly behind me. And I felt this presence come into my sphere or whatever. And I turned to my left and I looked up and I said, and who are you? Because I'm like, this is great. This is so great. This is all so great. And the answer, before I could even finish the question, the answer was, really got me. This is First Genesis 26. The answer was, you, Rosemary, you are the image and likeness. I'm the original. And I thought, whoa. It came not just with the words, but an infusion of understanding. I mean, I've always loved that Bible verse. And ever since then, I don't think a day of my life has gone by that I don't think about, I'm the image and likeness, but there's an original. And one day I was having a really bad day, feeling so sad. And I was in my kitchen and there was a bottle of juice on the countertop and it said, the original.
There you go, like a little reminder.
And it made me laugh out loud because I was like, oh yeah, there's an original. I'm going to be okay. There were so many things like this. There were so many things that happened. And so many life-changing things. But still floating away in this blackness. I remember thinking floating is a lot of fun. I was like, this is great. I don't know where we're going. I don't know who's driving this bus, but this is great. But one of the things that happened was I felt such a strong familiarity. And I thought, I've been here before. I mean, like in this 59-year span, I've been in this blackness floating away. And again, instantly, an angel, spiritual being that was with me said, yes, you have. Remember when your mother told you as a tiny infant that you were given up for dead? And yet, you know, you came back to life. She said, that actually wasn't a close call. You died then and you were sent back. Yeah. And I had never thought of that. I knew I was weird my whole life. You know, I could always hear the angel voices. Okay. You know, I was the person when somebody died, I'd say, oh, Aunt Sally just passed on. And they said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, she just came to say goodbye. Did you not see her?
How old were you when that happened, Rosemary? As a child, were you a little baby or you couldn't remember?
Oh, with the death?
Yeah.
My dying. I was a newborn baby and I contracted a staph infection at the hospital. Again, hospitals aren't great places for me. Well, I contracted a staph infection, turned into blood poisoning after 3 weeks. Again, this is 1959. But they said to my sweet mother, who had just done a vigil at my little bassinet, my little hospital crib, they said, okay, this is now in her organs. Her kidneys have failed. Everything else won't be far behind. And they said, go home and focus on your other three children. This one's gone. Wow. So my mother was sent home. And she didn't tell me about this until I was in my late 30s. My mother was sent home she was told, we're not going to let you sit here and watch her die. So she went home and she spent the night with a friend praying. And when she came back the next morning, because no news is good news. And no call came overnight. But she said she was at that hospital as soon as it opened at, you know, 7 or 8 in the morning. And she said, a nun was holding you. And my mom said, the nun handed you to me and said, she isn't better. She's healed.
Wow.
And so that was the story my mother told me. And so in this experience, in this blackness, the angel said, yeah, it wasn't that you got close to death. It's actually away you went and then you went back. So that explains so much. Because there's a woman, can't remember her name, P.H. Atwater. She's done a lot of studies on infant near-death experiences. And we're all a half bubble off plum. It's, you know, we just don't feel like we fit in. And we just want to go home. And I knew I was different. And my first experience with seeing stuff that others couldn't see was 4 or 5. And by the time you're in, like, I don't know, even elementary school, you learn to keep your mouth shut.
Sure.
You don't talk about that stuff. So this, and I was like, oh, you know what? That's great. That would have been good to know back there. But, you know, I'm in heaven now. No worries. On we go.
Right.
And I remember thinking.
That, you know what? Because, and the reason why I asked is that you were a little baby as far as conscious memory, in the sense of you, if you were thinking, okay, I'm imagining this whole conversation. But when that happened to you, you were basically a newborn.
Right.
Even though you said your mom told you, but that's incredible. That description is like, yeah, this is your second round on coming up here.
It was. There were so many things that happened. One of them was when I was, again, floating away in that blackness, I felt the presence of spiritual beings. And I recently told my daughter, if I had to sum the whole thing up in 3 words, it would be, of what I experienced in that, mm-hmm. it would be, welcome home, dearie. I was with my people. I found my tribe. And they surrounded me. And they just were like, we're so glad you're here. We're so happy to see you. We love you so much. You know, and they were just rejoicing. And I'm a perfectionist, and I have tortured myself with never accepting an imperfection. And that's a crummy, rotten, miserable way to live. And, you know, I like to say I've written 10 books, and I have, but writing them was not fun because I wanted them to be perfect. So just this thing that I am loved as is, is life-changing. And then also this thing that God likes us. I tell people that. They go, oh, no, God loves us. Yeah, we hear that a lot. But it also turns out that God likes us. And one of the biggest lessons I learned in heaven, and this was huge, my father abandoned us when I was 14. My father was a very unkind man. And he used to tell me that he would love me when I earned it. And that was very clear. Fatherly love was earned. And so I could never think of God as father, because that was like, I don't want any part of that. You know, if you say the wrong thing, they get in their 1967 Buick and take off. And that's what he did. But
well, no, you learned, made that link, that was a connection you made in your mind as far as the father thing.
It was. So I learned that God, our real heavenly father, is nothing like our earthly father. That God loves us, and God likes us, and God is happy with us, and God thinks we're just wonderful. And that's still sinking in. You know, this happened almost 5 years ago, and that's still sinking in somewhere, that God really likes us. Right. And on this went, and I know your time's limited, but this just went on and on. And then I was taken to a white room. And the thing is, I don't remember the transition from floating in that blackness to being on my feet in this white room. And it really feels like somebody took my batteries out. Because, you know, 1 minute I'm floating away and I'm thinking floating is fun. I like floating. This is great. Can't believe I talked like that, but I did. And then I'm standing on something approximating 2 legs and 2 feet in a white room. And in this white room, I saw a door on the far end, maybe, I don't know, 20 or 30 feet in front of me. And within the white room, there was a mist, and it was falling gently all around me. But it wasn't just falling. It was enveloping me, swirling around me, encasing me. And I asked about this mist, and I was told that some people get so intertwined with a disease process or a mental illness or emotional problems that they think that it's part of their nature, their soul, and that we go through something called a spiritual, my words, it's akin to a spiritual car wash, that this stuff is stripped away, and we're in a moment, in a second, we're released from these earthly shackles of pain or illness or a belief that's so heavily impressed on our thought. As my friend said, leave your muddy boots at the door. And so I'm walking through this white mist. I see a door, like I said, 20 or 30 feet in front of me. And I'm pretty interested by this fog that's moving, actively moving around me. And I said to the angel or spiritual being that was with me, I said, I feel like I should be able to focus on an individual droplet of this mist. And which is kind of funny. Next time you're in a fog, try to focus on an individual droplet.
Yeah.
It sounds crazy. But the angel said, your spiritual eyes have not acclimated to this yet, but these are particles of light. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. So I walk through this thing and I see the door and I'm pretty much saying to these angels that are accompanying me, and my angels, I didn't see them, but I felt them. I was just surrounded by this cloud of witnesses, as the Bible says. It does talk about a cloud of witnesses. I just thought about that. And they're right with me. They're like accompanying me to make sure everything's okay. And I'm told somewhere in this white room, somewhere in this experience, and I'm not told, but it's made clear to me, if I go back, I'll be healed. I'll go back. And the word healed wasn't used, the word whole. I'll be restored to wholeness if I go back. And I'm like, good to know. Out of my way, I'm doing the door.
It's like, okay, thanks, but no thanks. I'm just...
I really felt, and this is no joke, I mean, my whole life I've kept a gratitude list. Every morning I write out 5 things I'm grateful for, which is hard on the bad days. But sometimes it's, I saw a rainbow today, or I live in a house with air conditioning, or I sleep in a soft bed at night. I mean, you can always find, anybody in this country can find, you know, if you're living under a roof, you can find stuff to be grateful for. And throughout this whole experience, I kept thinking, I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful I'm in heaven. I'm so grateful that life is over. I'm so grateful I got away clean. There was really a very minimum of suffering in this whole thing. I'm so grateful it's over. I'm so grateful I'm going home. And so anyway, I see the door and I want to do the door. And it was communicated to me, if I went back, I'd be restored to wholeness. I was like, nope, 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 big nope, absolutely no. And then I'm at the door and I put my right hand up to push through this door, pretty compelled by the fact that right-handed on earth and right-handed in heaven. Oh, that's pretty cool. Okay. But as I do that, I pause and I asked, I intended to ask, is this the divine will for my life? And I couldn't even get past, is this divine? And the answer was immediate. And it was, no, this is not the divine will for your life. But the answer was, whatever you decide, if you decide to go forward on into heaven, or you decide to return to earth, you go with all of God's blessings and mercy and grace and care and love. Either way, you'll be richly blessed. And I thought, I'll take that deal. I want to go on to heaven. And then the next thing that happened, this was the deal killer. As I'm ready to move forward now, get through that door, I had a vision of that nurse who had shown me such motherly love and tender solicitude. And I see her, and this was not a concurrent event. I think this was a potential future, but I see her sitting in a hospital supply room. She's sitting on a little metal stool, surrounded by linens and other supplies in a little storage room, sitting on a little metal stool with her head in her hands, leaning forward and sobbing uncontrollably. And I see this. It's like I am a silent observer to this. She doesn't know I'm there, but I sure see her. And I hear her through tears, through heavy sobs. She says, I promised that woman that I wouldn't let her die, and I've lost her. I was like, oh, man, come on. Don't do this to me. And then I'm like, you know what? She signed up to be an RN. She's seen people die before. She's going to get over it. I need to go. Please don't ask me to go back to that mess of a life, that sorry life. And then I don't just see her suffering. I feel her emotional pain. And the best I can describe it is right in my chest. And it was too much. And I thought, I recognize that level of grief, regret, and despair. It was akin to what I had experienced, you know, during that time I grieved my husband. And I remember thinking, if I can save one person that much agony, I got to go back. Man, that was tough. And what's funny is the second I put my right hand back at my side, I was back in my body. There was no push. There was no going back. It was an instant the millisecond of a millisecond of that long. And I woke up in the flesh again, in this, you know, unpleasant heavy winter coat we all wear on earth. And the same nurse, I'm not sure, but she was right in my face. And she said, what is your name? And I said, Rosemary. And she said, what year is it? And I said, 2018. And she said, where are you? And I said, a crummy excuse for an ER.
It was like, you asked.
And so the point is, I'm sure they, I mean, I was dead more than 10 minutes. And
I was going to ask about, you, how long were you out? 10 minutes. What?
The interesting thing about dying from bleeding to death is they, and again, I interviewed several medical professionals. They can't do CPR when you've bled to death because all it does is push more blood out of your body. So yeah, what they do is they plug the leak. They plug the leak, as a doctor told me this. They plug the leak, they refill the tank, and then they restart the heart. So theoretically, my brain had no oxygenation for well more than 10 minutes. So the medical belief is after 5 or 6 minutes, you're mush. Right. So when that nurse was in my face asking me those questions, you know, I actually shared this story with an anesthesiologist, and he became emotional when I told him about the, you know, crummy excuse for an ER part. And I said, are you okay? And he said, I don't think you can understand how much relief they had in knowing they'd done the right thing and bringing you back. He said, sometimes when somebody's been gone that long and we resuscitate them, there's nothing there, you know?
Right. It's like
their heart, their heart may go, but that person is gone. And so the next morning, you know, I get transported to a real hospital.
Right.
And this time I get the doctors that are my age.
Okay.
And it was pretty cool. The next morning, a doctor comes in and he said, you've had a heart attack. And I said, not me. I bike, I walk. I'm in very good, healthy shape other than cancer. And he said, no, your enzymes were way elevated. You had a heart attack. I said, I don't understand. He said, you lost so much blood last night that your heart went into a V-fib, you know, which is where it just quivers. And he said, and then it stopped. So, and I said, I don't understand. And he said, well, he said, you lost so much blood. There was nothing to pump. And so your heart throws off these enzymes in a desperate bid to save itself. And he said, and then your heart stopped. So I have pretty cool medical documentation that I did die. This was not a close call. I died. So that first thought I had in the new experience, my heart has stopped. That was exactly right. That's precisely what happened.
So basically it was the heart. Let me ask you then, was it the heart attack that I want to say killed you or what, even though, because it almost sounds like you had the heart attack because of the loss of blood, but it was the heart attack where everything went stopped.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What I do know is, and I didn't know this. I thought when you ran out of blood, your heart was like, well, we're done. Got nothing to do here.
Right.
You know, I mean, the heart is a pump. And if there's no fluid moving through the pump, you know, it may quiver a little bit and say, what are we doing? So I don't know. I was actually surprised when he said that they could tell that I had had a heart attack and then my heart stopped. But what's really interesting is when I was resuscitated, my friend who had been a witness to this stuff, he said, when they wheel me out to the ambulance on the gurney, he said, you've heard the expression white as a sheet, but you were actually white as a sheet. And he said, your lips were indigo blue. Ooh. And he said, there was blue under your eyes. And he had been a medic for a time in the Army. And he said, I've seen corpses.
That I was look about better to say dead people that look like that.
And the really cool, I mean, there's a lot of levels to this, but one of the cool things, I was in the hospital for several days. It turns out when you die, you need a little attention. When my friends would leave the hospital room, because I had friends who'd come and sit with me, because, you know, when you're kind of in a semi-compromised state, you need somebody sitting there and make sure you don't get wheeled off for a kidney transplant or something, you know? when my friends would step out to get a bite or do whatever they needed to do, the angels would come stand by the bed. The angels would stand on both sides and at the foot of the bed, and they would sing me songs. And they sang me songs glorifying and praising God. And I would sob. I would sob when they sang to me. And I'd say, don't stop. But I've often likened it to putting 100,000 amps through a 60-amp breaker box. It was an infusion of pure energy, light, and love. And I said, I'm really, really good with houses, but melody and lyrics, I won't be able to remember this. And I want to not forget one note, but I said, I won't be able to remember this. And they said very clearly, they said, this is not for you to remember. This is for your peace. This is for your healing. And this is for your joy. And they also said, This is a thank you for agreeing to come back. We know how hard it is to see that and come back to this. But I've told this story probably 75 times, and I can never talk about the angels. I can never think about that memory again without feeling still very deeply stirred by it.
It makes you wonder, Rosemary, about people that have, that's happened to them. And maybe they do want to come back for, God, a multitude of reasons, kids, you know, whatever. And they're told, no, you cannot. You know, they don't have that choice. Because ultimately, like you said, you know, free will, that kind of thing. I think it always, it plays out always in everything. And
I don't know.
But it's, and then you think about, well, you know, you think about divine order. Was it what was meant to happen for you all along, but you still had to make that choice, you know? So that's
well, that's the beauty part about this is my three prayers, heal me or let me go. I got both.
I was going to say, you got it. So two, let me ask you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say two, I begged for no life review, had no life review. Three, I couldn't handle any more decisions. You know, I had decision fatigue. I had decision fatigue to a point that after my husband's death, I bought a dozen white polo shirts and four pairs of jeans. So every morning I could open the closet and put on a white shirt and the blue jeans, and I was good to go. The beauty part about this is that thing when I was told, either way, you'll be richly blessed. Okay. I thought, wow. When I see now more clearly, I still get tangled up in decision fatigue, but I remember, if we are trying to do the will of God, if we are trying to seek the wisdom of God and make good choices, we're not going to get it wrong. We may go to the left of the rock in the stream instead of the right. Mm-hmm. We may take a little longer path through the woods, but we're going to end up in the right place if we're really striving to listen and do the right thing by God. I am sure of that. So those three prayers got answered in beautiful ways. And then that image of the nurse, you know, sobbing and so upset was God's, I really believe it was God's way of saying, let me help you with this decision.
Right. And let me ask you, how soon afterwards did your doctor say, oh, by the way, you're, you know, besides having had a heart attack, you had this terminal disease.
Yeah, kind of a big deal.
Right, exactly. That you like got the second whammy, like, wow.
Well, when I came back from this thing, I felt, as soon as I woke up, I mean, as soon as I was resurrected or restored or whatever, I felt completely different. I mean, I knew everything had changed. I knew every cell in my body was different. In fact, when I was lying in the hospital bed the first night, because they had large bore needles and IVs just going constantly trying to get me back, you know, I mean, in the hospital. And they were bringing me apple juice and cranberry, whatever I asked for. They said, you just keep drinking. And I did. They actually, this is kind of funny. So when they were putting me in a room, after I had come off the ambulance, I've been transported to the hospital. And they're, you know, I got the gurney and I've got a couple people following the gurney and my IVs. They're holding my IVs. And yeah, we're all going down the hall, quite a parade going down the hall with Rosemary on the gurney. Well, I look up and there's a sign hanging from the suspended ceiling tiles of this hospital and it says oncology ward. Well, I start trying to sit up in that gurney and I'm trying to grab those big plastic rails on the side that they have on the walls. Uh-huh. And I say, you turn this ship around. I am not a cancer patient. I am not going to be put on an oncology ward. You turn this thing around. And I'm trying to grab with my little tight fingers to say, I am not going to be a cancer patient. You turn this thing around right now. And this nurse came up and she's prying my fingers off. I only got to the bed rail. Yeah. And she said, this is also for overflow. And I'm pretty sure they just told me that.
right. Yeah. Because let me ask at this point, these people didn't know what your prognosis was from before. All they had was someone that was.
They knew I had a biopsy for, I don't know who knew, but I mean, the fact that I ended up on an oncology ward was pretty telling. I'm sure it was in my chart, but I knew everything had changed. And when I was in that hospital bed, I think it was the first night, maybe early on in the experience, I felt like around my intestines, like my midsection, I felt off. And I asked the angels, I said, something's not right. I don't feel right. What's going on? And the angel said, and this is so amazing. The angel said, we're still doing some restorative work. You're still being healed and reset. And they said, but it's okay. Everything's going to be all right. And I remember that weird feeling just again in my midsection. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to be all right. And people come back from this. They say they feel like they're 50% in that world and 50% in this world. I was not. I was 95% back in heaven and 5% in this world. I could see when people would walk into the room. I remember one nurse walked into the room at 3 a.m. like they do. And she smiled at me. And it's like the whole room lit up with all this light. You know, it's like that smile was so full of love. It just filled the room with love. And I started to cry. And this woman, this nice nurse, she comes over to me and she said, are you okay? And I said, I felt your love. So I was really extra sensitive.
She must be thinking, yeah, I'm giving her good drugs.
I know. And they, to answer your question, I knew everything had changed. I knew every single thing had changed. And then I did have an appointment with my oncologist after I was out of the hospital. And I told him that I probably didn't need the chemo and the radiation because I'd been healed in heaven. And what happened with that was he put mentally ill on my chart.
What?
And yeah, what? He did. That's for real. And he said, look, we caught this early. You know, you got 70%. What they told me, they said I had a 70% chance of being healed with one course of chemotherapy. And, I said, I don't think I'm going to do that. And that was a very hard decision for me because after I told him, after I declined chemo, he described in some very graphic ways how I would die. And it ended with drowning in my own fluids. And he said, I don't know what you think you're doing, but this natural stuff is insane. And he said, I get called in at the end when natural treatments fail. And he said, you're going to die a terrible death. And that was very unnerving to me. You know, it really undid me. And his office continued to call me for a long time and said, you need to be in here. And then I went, I had to find another oncologist in another part of the state, a gynecological oncologist. And she did lots and lots of tests. And every test she, I mean, she did a physical exam. And with every test she did, we did PET scans, MRIs with contrast, without contrast, lots of stuff was done. Every test that came back, she'd say, Rosemary, if you have cancer, I sure don't see where it is. But she said, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's do some more stuff. And then she did a second surgical biopsy. And they wanted to wait. I think she waited a month to make sure that I had recovered from this whole thing. Actually, she waited 2 months. And she was pretty nervous because this first oncologist was, you know, a big deal, big important doctor. And she was very nervous and she took a lot of flesh from a whole lot of places. And she also had another doctor in the operating room. And those two doctors, you know, whatever they do with samples, you know, they look down every which way. But she actually, that doctor who did the second surgical biopsy, she, according to my friend, again, waiting in the waiting room for me, he said she burst through the doors and threw her arms around his neck and said, she's right. There is not one cell of cancer that I can find anywhere in her body. And she said, and not only is she healed, she said her flesh is so pink and pretty and perfect. I wouldn't believe she ever had cancer if I hadn't seen the test.
Wow. They must have been, because they were thinking, how could this other doctor, in other words, I don't think that they were thinking he had lied. What I think was, sounds like they, it was difficult for them to accept was that you had been healed after that near-death experience.
Right. Because what started all this was a lot of symptoms, a lot of bad symptoms. And then I had, my first appointment was just with a regular gynecologist. And they did the pap smear, you know, in several places. And they came back and they said, yeah, you've got, you know, you've got this thing. And they referred me to the oncologist. My point is, this wasn't one doctor. This was this was two doctors and three exams.
Okay. And that, that,
so it was a big deal.
That doctor must have been like, oh, it is. You know, in other words, she even brought in other doctors, like a consult.
She did. Let's, And that wasn't it. She sent the tissue samples off to other labs. mm-hmm. Yeah. She sent tissue samples off to other labs, and that all came back clean. So she was very thorough.
So what happened then to your, I want to say, regular life? That wasn't regular anymore, I guess.
Well, I sold everything I own. I came back because I had been, I had stuff. You know, I'd inherited stuff from my mom and had a couple heirlooms and stuff like that. And I had moved that stuff from house to house through the course mm-hmm. of a life. And I realized the happiest I had ever been was floating away from my body with nothing. So I started selling off all my material possessions. And I did. I kept my clothes. I even sold my car. Okay. Took it back to the dealership. And it was a new car. I had waited mm-hmm. 2 months to get that car. But I bought a little Prius C to replace a used car, which suited me better. And then I sold furniture and lamps and, gosh, yard furniture and end tables and dining room tables. I sold everything, every single thing I had, most of the furniture. And then I moved 1,000 miles due west. I wanted to be, I'm living in the Midwest. I just wanted to be around beauty. I wanted to be, I don't know if you've ever been to like parts of Illinois and Iowa, but they have like in the southern part of the state, southwestern, they have the rolling hills because of the limestone bluffs. And so you can look at these expansive farm fields where they grow corn and soybean. And you can see for miles and miles.
I've driven through there. How's that? I've driven on the roads.
And in late summer.
I know what you're talking about, those fields that seem endless. Like they go off.
And in the summer, in the summertime when the summer thunderstorms come through, and you can see those clouds forming on the distant horizon. And then when the wind comes through, and you see all the tassels on the top of the corn stalks just gently sway in this perfect unity. And it's so peaceful. So I wanted to be around beauty. That was what I craved. And it's still what I crave. So, you know, my life has been messy at times even now. Being in this human experience is hard. I thought I'd come back and be, you know, enlightened and holy and perfect and good.
Yeah, but we exist in a world with a bunch of people that are not. No, I mean, we aren't, but it's still, it's like, and.
I know. And I, you know what, an aside, and you know, just between us and, you know, however many listeners you got, I was single for 5 years and I dated a guy. I dated a guy that I thought was super duper and he turned out to not be super duper. Okay. And, I was like, how did this happen to me? Uh-huh. I'm enlightened. I've been to heaven. How did this happen to me? But it did. So I think one of the biggest problems of coming back from an NDE, I mean, there's a lot of issues. You know, depression is very common in people who come back from an NDE. Because at first you're elated.
Right. And then first you're like, all of a sudden it's not, you realize where you're back is not heaven. It's kind of like.
And like this fellow I was dating, you realize not everyone is pure and good and full of light and love. Yeah. And that's that got me. That really got me. So I'm, you know, I'm still, I don't know. And yet another, I mean, I've had overwhelmingly good experiences. You know, mm-hmm. my point is you still get into the muck of life so easy. You think you're walking along the path of life and it's all going well. And then you find yourself in quicksand like mud that's up to your hips and you're thinking, how did this happen to me?
Right.
Like, well, you're on Earth. This Earth is full of
I think that, you know, you hear about these gurus and these people that are enlightened, but they live on the mountain and of course and they're aesthetics. And of course they don't get messy. You know, they don't have to deal with life. But I think that
that's
life
a great
is supposed
point.
To be messy. You know, when you engage with other people. You know, because that is what it is. Either, you know, you get people that are unkind and others that are, they have good intentions, but still, I mean, it's just, but I think that, I personally think that we're put here to engage in life. We are. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like the challenge.
We're social animals. Man, is it? But that's a really good point. If you live a monastic life, it's a lot easier.
Can you imagine? Everything, even if, like you said, even a monastic or, you know, you hear about these, you know, even some of these orders that they even take a vow of silence. I'm thinking, that's it. Most of your problems have gone away because all you have to do is meditate or pray or whatever the case might be and live a very orderly existence. That is so true. And it's out here in the real world where things get like people run you off the road, they flip you off, you know, things like that, where it's like,
that is so true.
And
that's, I had never thought about that, but you're exactly right. And when you self-isolate, it's a lot easier, isn't it?
Of course. And don't get me wrong. There's times, depending, of course, on your personality and everything, whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, where you have to isolate. It's like, okay, I need to veg out just for a while here and, you know, get centered. Yeah. But you know, you're going to get pulled back in. Sometimes I think people don't realize, Rosemary, as kind of as challenging as living without a purpose, you know. Oh, there was this old, what was it, Twilight Zone show, and I never forgot it. And it shows, and you might have seen it once I start talking about it, there's a thief, and he's running away from the police, and the next thing he wakes up, and he's like in a... this nice like saloon kind of tavern bar. And he wakes up and there's this gentleman dressed in white and he's thinking, this is God. I'm gone to heaven. And everything is there for him. Beautiful women. He gets to drink whatever he wants. There's a pool table. He shoots pool, but of course all the women want him. He gets whatever he wants. He shoots pool and he always wins. There's no challenges. There's nothing wrong. So he goes up to the guy dressed in white with his three, and he goes, you know, hey, you know what? This is heaven, blah, blah, blah. This is not what I thought. He goes, the guy turns around and goes, who told you this was heaven? You know, in other words, for human beings, for everything to be given to you without, and I don't want to say, believe me, I'm not a friend of adversity. Hello, I'm a wimp when it comes to that. But if there's no purpose for us or things to overcome, then I think we kind of like are not that happy either. You know, we all need something to conquer.
Yeah, I'm happy to, you know, turn it down on the adversity a bit and just go for the easy.
Of course. Of course. We all are. We all are. Of course. Of course. When I mean adversity, I don't want to make it sound that dramatic, but just the everyday life and what comes with it. You know?
Yeah.
And
that is so true.
So you moved out and then you wrote your book about your experience, right?
It took me three stinking years. I had no intention of writing that book. No intention. I am not a fan of writing. Who was it? Some woman. Oh my gosh. I can't remember who said it, but there's a famous quote. I hate writing. I love having written. That got it. And one woman, I you know, back in the day when I did this in live audiences, this one woman, I shared a story about an encounter with a medical professional and she said, you've got to write this down. I said, no. And then I kind of had an angel appear at my side and say, is the book done?
Is that hint, hint?
No. And he said, get it done. I was like, okay. But the
like,
story,
you know, when you're having a baby, when you're having the baby, it's like, I'm ready to punch anybody out, you know, and then after you have the baby, it's like, oh, it was wonderful. Let me ask you, when you see angels,
yes,
do you sense them? Do you see them? Do you hear them?
You know, it's the word angel comes from the Greek for messenger. And have the thing is, when I say angels, I hear their voice. That's the most predominant facet. Okay. But those beings at my hospital bed, they were more real than anybody. They were more real than any human being I have ever known. They were legit. And the one that I was actually sitting in a church service, minding my own business, and it was a Methodist church, and they have this thing where they call bringing in the light. And it's where, I guess, acolytes bring in a big tall candle, and then they light the candles at the altar with it. Well, so the acolytes go through with a big tall candle thing on a stick, and then the minister is behind them. And then I noticed an angel is behind the minister. And I was like, what? And then he stops, the angels, and it's like Gabriel. I'm like, come on, Gabriel, you know, like wearing 100 AD Roman garb warrior stuff. And I was like, you look just like the little statue I have on my nightstand at home. Okay. I mean, you know, not very creative. But anyway, yeah, he stops at the pew. And I said, in my mind, I said, you're here. And he, that's when he talked about the book. And he said, what he said was, stop worrying about your pride. I'd had a stomach ache. He said, stop worrying about your pride, your stomach, and was something else. What was something about your pride, your stomach, and something else. And he said, get that book done. I was like, okay.
And I was did you feel like there were different angels, or were these the same angels that had been with you at the hospital? I don't know if there's a way to tell.
The fellow who I encountered in the church was definitely a different angel, because what had happened, this was 6 months after my surgery, the second surgery where they did the surgical biopsy. And I had what I guess, who knows, but I think I had surgical, what do they call them? Adhesions, where little scar tissue forms internally. And because she took out a lot of stuff to, you know, check for those, those biopsies. And I had not been able to digest food normally. And I had stopped eating and I had terrible nausea and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Right. And I was sitting in that church, and the what that angel said was, gosh, stop worrying about your pride and maybe your ego and your stomach, and which I thought was really funny because I had been having such stomach pain. Okay. And then the angel shared a Bible verse with me, and the Bible verse that came to mind was, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. And I've been so worried about whatever's going on in my tummy. I mean, I was really suffering quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I felt as this angel, surely the Lord is in this place and I knew it not. I thought that applies to me inside. Surely the Lord is even there where I'm having so much pain. And I felt something pop internally and all the nausea and all that pain was gone like that. And that's why the angel said, stop worrying about your stomach and your pride and go write this book. And after the service, this is my first time to this little Methodist church in Illinois. The minister came up to me and he shook my hand. And before I could say anything, he said, you're actually glowing. Do you know that? And I said, yeah, I know. He said, no. So I know this was legit. And, you know, I went home and I had two sandwiches immediately. I mean, I'd been so hungry. And then I went out to a restaurant with a friend and ate another lunch. But that was the message, is get that book done. That was not, in the name of light and love, finish the book. It was, hey, you, get that book done.
Right. Yeah, it's like.
I get the angry angels.
Right, yeah. Like, get to it. Right, you know, and it's like, yeah, you know, and it's funny that you say that, because everybody always thinks that you would think that these angelic messages would be like you said, like, let me strum the harp. And tell you really not, please. Well, and it was like that.
I know.
And you know what? And it's really funny because I guess, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Prophecy, where Christopher Walken played the part of Gabriel.
Yes.
And I have such a hard time. Every time now I think of the angel Gabriel, I'm thinking of Christopher Walken with his long hair, even though the way they portrayed him, obviously the angels is different, but it's like, yeah, all right, you ruined it for me with Gabriel, Christopher Walken.
But you know, the story I was going to say about this medical professional, this is back in the day when I did these talks live, I told this story, gosh, I apologize to the people who went to one of my early talks, because they were terrible. You know, I rambled and, you know, went off. No one cares what happened. All anyone wants to hear about is how did you die and what's it like to die? That's all, you know, you can tell about the suicide and despondency and living. Nobody cares. All they want to know is what's it like to die.
Right.
It took me a while to learn that lesson. So if you went to one of my early lectures, I'm really sorry about all that. So one of the things I shared was day two, I don't know, after my husband's death, I literally could not swallow fluid. You can live a while without food, but not fluid. And I was in shock. I was in deep shock. So my daughter took me to one of these little fast care medical places. Right. And the doctor comes, and my daughter was in her late 20s at the time. And the doctor comes in and, you know, he's light and breezy and he's got my very thin manila folder medical file. And he goes, so ladies, what's the problem today? And my daughter says, well, her husband killed himself and my mother can't swallow any food. We need something to calm her down a little. And the doctor, true story. The doctor goes, Oh my gosh. And then he says, the same thing happened to my Aunt Bertha. It was 45 years ago and she was never right in the head again.
Oh my God. Are you serious? He said that. I'm sorry.
And I remember I'm sitting on the edge of the exam table. You know, I'm sitting on the edge trying to be perky, good right. Southern lady, never let him see you sob. And I said, you know what? Forget the tranquilizers. You got some arsenic in that little apothecary there.
Right. Yeah.
But what my daughter did,
she must have, I would have,
I think he was shocked. I was so proud of my little girl. You know, she's 20, I think 28 at the time. She looked at him and she was, you know, she was a force. She looked at him and she said, "Doctor, that is not helpful. Are you going to be able to help my mother or not?"
Right,
and I was like,
exactly.
Go Corey. And what he did, to his credit, because I mean, this brought back a memory. This obviously brought back a very hard memory for him. It was like it all went away. He instantly goes, "Yes, yeah, I'm sorry. All right, yeah, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you 60 count of Valium right away. Give her half of one to begin, and just probably calm her right down. She'll at least be able to swallow fluids again." I mean, he really did come around very quickly. But he literally went, "Oh my gosh, oh my gosh!" And so my friend,
wasn't in that day that they took sensitivity training. What?
I think it shocked him. I think it very much shocked him. And so when I gave this talk at a public lecture. That was when this woman said to me, she was a nurse or somewhere in the medical profession. She said, "You need to tell the story because we don't know how to deal with trauma. You know, we're learning how to deal with schizophrenia, bipolar, borderline personality, you know, all these difficult DSM-5 things." But she said, "We don't know how to deal with trauma. You were not mentally ill. You were severely traumatized and in shock."
Sure.
And she said, "That's why you need to write the book so medical professionals can understand. This is a big deal. You do not say, 'Oh my gosh, oh my gosh. The same thing happened to my Aunt Bertha 45 years ago, and she was never right in the head again.'"
Of course not.
Even if you're thinking that.
Right. Even if he thinks, "Oh my God." But yeah, it's like, obviously, here's this person who's, something's going on with her. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. But that's, I don't think you need that much training to realize. You know, at the very least, it's like, don't share the story about your Aunt Bertha and how she was never right in the head again. It's like, that's pretty insensitive. Well, there.
I used to be a volunteer chaplain at a secured facility for the criminally insane. And we had to go through a lot of training to be a volunteer chaplain. But one of the first lessons we learned, and I thought it was, I think I wish everyone could learn this lesson. No matter what you're told, what you hear, what you see, don't ever appear shocked.
Right.
Because that just adds to the agitation and the upset and the general mental atmosphere of panic. So no matter what happens, never look shocked. I thought that was great advice. And I guess the doctor should have had that advice too.
Even if inside you're going,
Yeah, and I mean, to his credit, obviously this was a very difficult memory. But still, never appear shocked. Yeah, which held me in good advice when I was a mother too.
Well, you know, sometimes you can't help that when you're a mom. It's like, what?
You know, "Hey mom, I'm marrying that boy you don't like."
What?
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. So what is it you like about him? Yeah.
I think it was very good advice. That's one person that can make you do away with your best intentions or your children. Especially when they do something like that or say something like that. You're like, you know what? What? Yeah.
I know.
But so are you going to go back? I was going to say, are you going to write again? But it sounds like, you know, either to writing more book. No, that's it. Not even books about.
Again, if that angel shows up at my next church service, I guess the decision is not mine. Uh-huh. Actually, I am going to write a book for my children. I've got three adult daughters. My goal is to write a book about the times I have felt the presence of angels, like that story about the angel that showed up by the church pew. I plan to write about the times I've actually felt the presence of angels and share that with them, just so they know. Sure. Because I think my children are very, very sensitive to that stuff, too.
Of course.
And also it helps me.
To believe your parents. You know, you're thinking, if anybody's, my mom would not lie about something like this, you know.
Well, you know, my children have read, two of my children have read my book and they liked it, which was great. You know, if your children like your book, you're in.
Yeah, of course. I know.
I have another family member that read my book who shall not be named, actually a couple of them, who said I made the whole thing up. And I was like, oh, wait, I used to be a reporter. And if I believed somebody was making something up, I would go to them and say, so what hospital were you at? What doctor did you see when you got that first diagnosis? That must have been frightening. What was that like? You ask questions. Sure. And I think I'm coming to realize the family is just kind of a microcosm of what's happening in the world. And I think what is really going on is, one, they wonder, why did I have this experience?
Yeah, I was about to
say. I don't know. And your family of origin can be more like, do you know who she really is? The goofball, the weirdo?
Yeah, why her? I mean, yeah. I say sometimes family of origins, you know, they're the ones that, do you remember what happened 30 years ago when you did that and that and that and that? And you're like, no, but thanks for reminding me. You know, they're the ones, you know, the holder of all the, and you know, and I think that a lot of times, Rosemary, people fail to forgive themselves because their families, despite whatever the intentions are, don't let them forgive themselves for past mistakes and just bad judgment. It happens to everybody.
You know, Jesus said, a man's foes will be those of his own household. Yeah. And that is so true.
Yeah. And sometimes it's intentional. A lot of the times it's unintentional. You know, like, oh, we're telling you this so you won't be disappointed. It's like, all right. That kind of deal.
I know. Yeah. And it boggles the mind. If I had a family member with a cool story like this, I'd sit him down and say, so.
Yeah, right. Sure. Like, let me hear all the details that you didn't put in the book or whatever. Yeah, give me all the juicy parts. Like, yeah, the ones that you thought, maybe I'll leave that part out.
There are a few parts.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, usually it comes down to exactly what you said at the beginning. Why her? You know, what's so, you know, even though if you look at it on the outside, it's you died. You know, you had a horrific experience, another horrific experience with your diagnosis, and then this happens. But somehow or other, they see the specialness of it. I hate to say it, at the end, you know, and it's like, well, why did she get to be special? You know, that kind of thing.
Have you seen the movie Breakthrough about the young man? It was actually in Wentzville, Missouri, not terribly far from where I was living, but have you seen that movie?
No. Why does it sound familiar though? That title sounds familiar.
What it's about? Cool. So this kid, a young man, I think he was 14. His name was, the last name, his family name was Smith. His name was Joseph. Anyway, he fell through the ice. And he was submerged for 40 minutes and they tried to resuscitate him. They tried at the hospital to resuscitate him. It was at Cardinal Glennon Hospital in Wentzville, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis. Anyway, the doctors the whole way for the first 48 hours said his lungs are filled with filth and bacteria. And I mean, every part of the way they said, no way, no way, no way, no way, no way, no way. Even resuscitating him after 40 minutes in the ice. Okay. But the boy walked out of the hospital after 14 days, 100% fine. And even the neurologist took the mother aside and said, this is a miracle. This is a bona fide, real deal miracle. He said, there is no way. And they never removed the water from his lungs. 1 minute that filthy lake water was there, and the next minute it was gone. It wasn't that he expelled it. It just went. And I mean, all the doctors called it a real deal miracle. Well, the mother wrote a book about it, and it was turned into a movie, and the movie's called Breakthrough. But the reason, of course, I love the movie, but there's a scene where the kid's back at school, and everyone's so grateful that this young man's back at school, this sweet, nice boy. But he goes to his locker, and it's covered in Post-it notes. And most of them are welcome back or we love you, but several of them are, how come you're alive and my mother is dead? Why did your prayers work and mine didn't? Yes. What makes you so special? And I get those in emails. My website, by the way, is temporarydeath.com. I wasn't near death. I was temporarily dead. But I get those emails a lot. Why you? What's so special about you? I don't have an answer. I don't know.
Exactly. And I think that's what happens sometimes.
Special about me.
Right. And it's like, that's your life path, whatever it is. And other people's are different. You know, it's just like, again, you know, you hear about people sometimes having horrific accidents or things and they walk away, or they survive and then others. Sometimes people die from the most simplest thing that sometimes isn't life-threatening to begin with, and it turns out to be fatal. So, yeah.
I don't have those answers.
No, I don't think. And it almost sounds like what you were describing is, even though, you know, you always hear about us having free will, there's always also, I want to say there's almost an element of predestination sometimes, as far as maybe what we should go through. Maybe we'll go this way versus that way or whatever, you know. But there's some things that always we're meant to face. I'm thinking, that's just me assuming a lot, you know, how that goes. Rosemary,
and that's the thing, there are unanswerable questions.
Of course.
No, I'm sorry, I was just saying there are many unanswerable questions
that we will never, I mean, it's great to ponder it. And I think some people are, I hate to say it, are always even looking for the guru who's going to give them all the answers. And then that's it. I've got it figured out and I don't have to worry about, you know, anything because I know what it is. And it's like, nah, I don't think that we're, I almost want to say, for lack of a better word, again, I come back to it. I think that if we knew, we wouldn't want to be here. You know, part of it is like figuring it out as you go along. Doing it right, or doing it wrong and going, oh my God, that was a big mistake. You know, and I sometimes think some mistakes are minor and then other things are horrific in the sense of the repercussions are really bad. But I think that's the human experience. But you also pointed out we do have a lot of things to be grateful for, a lot. Again, Rosemary, it has been absolutely great to talk to you. And I'm hoping you're going to write that other book, even if it's, you know, I'm hoping that Gabe is going to pay you a visit and say, all right, Rosemary, we've given you some downtime. So get back over there. Get to the computer right now, you know, something like that. Man. It's like, nah, we're not even going to go through the soft touch at the beginning. We're going to we figure it out with you. Let's forget it.
It's the dope slap. Hello.
Yeah, it's like, nah, it's like
McFly.
Okay. Right, exactly, McFly. You know, and let's see if Gabe shows up again, you know, to be the messenger on that one. It's like, nah, you're not off the hook. We didn't send you back just for that. No.
Oh, man.
You never know. Again, Rosemary, has been absolutely wonderful. And I want to wish you best of luck on all your future projects. It's been great.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Let me tell you, when you hear Rosemary's story, it's sad. It's very sad, but at the same time, it's a very beautiful story. You know, because, you know, a lot of, you know, she endured what sounds like what could be one of the most difficult experiences a person can have. And then add to that, her health problems. And it's like, boy, and you know what, contrary to what a lot of people think, you know, if you ever want to, when you have a lot to live for in the sense, excuse me, of like what she was describing, I had this great life, you know, all my, everything was there, was okay, it was good, it was wonderful, you know, and then everything takes a turn and then takes another turn. And it's like, wow, how did I get from where I was at, that world I was living in, that existence, to where I'm at now? And you could tell she was, I hate to say, she, you know, she was a victim of circumstances that occurred to her, but also she really, she was very difficult on herself, to the point, like when she says that, once I was freed of everything, what I was most happy about was I was freed of all this mental, emotional, spiritual, I don't want to say baggage, because baggage is encompassing, but all these feelings and whatever. And And then she comes back and she has all these experiences, and she just like, I like that. I love that story that she says about, I got rid of everything. I sold my car. I sold all the junk. And I'm going to say this because I'm guilty of this myself. And I think, you know, once upon a time, and I'm sure wherever you at, you're at, sometimes you go in the middle of nowhere and there's a storage place. And once upon a time, for those of you who've been alive, these things of storage places was not as popular as they are now. Like that, on every street corner, you've got a storage. Why? Because people have got so much junk. All right. And, or you see people garages, they open them and there's no car in there. It's full of chock full of stuff. So this thing that, you know, talk about consumerism that we're hooked on. And when she's saying, I got rid of everything, I just like, and you realize how much of these things that we collect, that we have, that we think we need, that they're, or I spent a lot of money, or don't get me wrong, I think it's nice when you have things that you like, but sometimes we get carried away and it's the act of possessing it versus enjoyment of it. In other words, I have it, I bought it, and then I'm going to put it back there and then that's it. I have it. It's mine. And then, you know, in other words, you find, I think at other times that really what you need to, and I know there's a lot of people out there that go, I've bought this and I really enjoy it. But I think there's a lot of times that we get so many things, material things that in the end don't make a difference one way or another towards our happiness. Not really. Or maybe the gratification is like for a little bit after you get it. And then, and I'm going to give you a perfect example. 2 years ago, when we sold our house within 24 hours, we had a two-story house, 2,500 square feet or more. And I was moving a few hundred miles within the state. And I had 45 days to get out. All right. And believe it or not, that's when you find out, especially how much junk. And when I say junk, I don't mean junk in the sense, because normally I'm not a hoarder or anything like that. If something was old or used up or something, I would donate it. I would get rid of it. But how much stuff that we had, I was almost, that at the end of the day, when I was taking it out and putting it away, and what am I going to do with this? I realized, man, you know, I haven't used this in a year, 2 years. What am I doing with it? Yeah, it was this mentality that you have that as long as you had a place to store it, it's there. I have it. And then you realize I haven't used it. You know, it's just taken up space and it's been there because, okay, it's easier to do that than to think of, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to sell it? Am I going to donate it? Am I put in the trash if it's not any good? Even though, like I said, I was pretty good about stuff like that, if it's not good anymore. And again, I had a really, and I'm going to use this coming to Jesus moment about that, where me and my husband promised ourselves that besides the fact that we moved into a place with half the size, we promised ourselves never again were we going to do that as far as holding on to things, accumulating things, things of this nature, you know, nothing. We were like, it was like, we promised we were going to beat the other one up. If, you know, and every time we're going to buy one, something, or we'll stop and go, number one, do I really need it? Or we really need it. And number two, do I have the space for it? Because that's one of the things also. When you have less space to store stuff, you have to really think about, hey, what am I going to put this? All right. And so I like that part of her story where she just like, she let go of all these things. All right. Because she realized, I guess when you really, when you go from that deep unhappiness to finally coming back and you kind of like, and here I'm putting words in her mouth, you know, you look at what really makes you happy, what really is important to your day-to-day contentment. And you realize, man, all those things like didn't do nothing for my happiness or my contentment or my will to live or anything. They didn't do absolutely nothing. So I think that that's a good lesson to be learned because unfortunately, I think that we sometimes get carried away with that. And you know, when it comes to happiness, I think human beings are simpler than we give ourselves credit to be. We're complex, but at the same time, we're very simple creatures. I'm going to say a lot of the media and consumerism, they make us believe that when we have this, we'll be happy. You know, that'll make you happy. And we're kind of force fed this through different versions of whatever. Come to find out, a lot of people that when they get the whatever it is, fill in the blank, it's like, okay, yeah, I have it. It's nice. It's great. Wow. But, you know, it's not everything you thought it was going to be. So there you go. Again, guys, thank you for being part of my audience. Thank you very much for coming every week, spending this time with me. I've got a lot of fantastic guests coming on. Repeat ones, new ones like Rosemary. I urge you to go to our website. There's going to be a link in the credits of the show, which is temporarydeath.com. All right. And like I said, I'm hoping, well, she's got the books on home improvement. And then she's got this last book. I'm hoping she does do another book. All right. Like I said, I hope Gabe catches up with her and taps her on the shoulder, says, back to work, Rosemary. Sign up for my newsletter. All right. And again, if you want to see or listen, first of all, I have links to all the shows for the video version. If you want to listen to any of the podcast versions of any of the shows, whether it's Stories of the Supernatural, Supernatural Storytime, Nightshade Diary, Eerie News, whatever, I've got links there where you can listen on the browser or download the MP3 without commercial interruption. So, again, I will be seeing you next week with a fantastic show. You're going to really like it. Till then, take care.